accession number 26848, reel 4.
Mr. Broomfield, reel 4. Now, we're talking about codes and ciphers. Ciphers are meant to be for officers, but you did learn them as well. So yeah. Could you carry on talking about both these things?
Yes. The reason we were taught codes and ciphers is that if you were on a small ship, very often you didn't have the luxury of a chap to just to do codes alone. You'd have to do your own coding and decoding. And sometimes, if you're on a small ship, the officer would ask you to help him out doing the ciphers. It was only a different set of books. The procedures were the same. And you had different prefixes to messages which would indicate their importance, the degree of priority to be attached to them. Because when you're at sea, you receive several kinds of messages. You have what they call broadcast messages, which is like listening to the radio all the time. And you don't know what the message is about because it's all in code. Until you start to decode it, you don't even know it's for you. So you'd need to, the captain would need to know what's going on in the area. So you'd take...
Don't get too much into what you're doing, because we're going to come to all this later.
Okay,
sticking more to the codes and ciphers rather than...
Right.
So how would you actually do it?
There were books which you had on board the ship which had lead covers. The lead was there to sink them in the event of, so that they didn't fall into German hands. And the type of code that you would use would be indicated in the preamble to the message, so you know which book to use, and they would be changed from day to day. This was in the signal, you see. So that you'd have a number of books and you wouldn't use the same one all the time. We also had at one stage on the ship a machine like the Enigma machine on my ship.
But you didn't do that in training?
Didn't do that in training, no. But in training I was instructed with the... We had signal pads and the codes were normally five figures. So each five figures you would decode by use of these books to send the message.
And that would give you the letters?
That would give you, well, not only the letters, sometimes phrases to shorten the message down.
Now, anything else you were learning in London?
It was all tied up with hearing the Morse code. We weren't instructed in reading a lamp in London.
It was just Morse?
Just purely... They had buzzers, they didn't have any other equipment in the house, and it was purely getting us proficient at learning audible Morse.
Now, did you find it tiring? Some people find Morse very tiring.
No. We'd start of a morning and we'd have a break stand easy. I know we used to go from this house across the road, just by the hospital, into a cafe and have a cup of tea and cake or something. And then back to Morse again, and then I can't remember where we had our dinner. That's gone. I don't know where the dinner came from. And then we'd carry on until about 4 in the evening, and then I'd go back to the hotel, and then I'd be free in the evening to go to the pictures or walk now, about or
you,
whatever.
I don't know whether it's a nice story. You said you met your wife while you were there.
Yes, I met my wife on the very first day I came to London. That's why I remember it was in August. It was a lovely August evening. I'd come down on the train to London. I'd never been to London in my life, and I was taken to this hotel and given this bedroom. Then in the evening I walked down Highbury Grove, across Highbury Fields, which is quite a well-known place, into the Holloway Road, which is a main road, and I walked past a building which I now know was Central Library, Islington, and I heard music. And I've told you, I was keen on dancing, and I actually couldn't find out where the music was coming from and wanted to walk away. And I determined to go back, and it was on the first floor. It was a room over the library, and it was being run as a dance. There's a dance going on. It was a Saturday night. And into this dance I went, and that's when I met my wife. She was with a girlfriend. She'd got a boy who was in the Navy. He was away at sea, Frank. And this girlfriend of hers, she really wanted to palm me off onto her friend. Her friend's name was Gladys Foster. Anyway, I took Gladys Foster and I took my wife, Doris, home. But I wanted to see Doris again. And I made a date for the next night. But she wouldn't go on her own. She wanted to go with her friend. So I said, I'll take the pair of you. So I took the two of them to a cinema up Holloway Road, not far from where our training centre was. And it was interesting. I only went to that cinema once with them, and several days later a bomb came and it was out of action for the rest of the war. And that's how the friendship developed. She told me about her boyfriend. He was only a boyfriend. She wasn't engaged. He belonged to a youth club that she was in. And we reached the point where we were getting very, very entangled. And there was some suggestion of her writing to him and telling him. And I said, no, this is true. This is not a fairy. I wouldn't like to get a letter like that when I was at sea. Tell him when he comes home on leave. So he did come home on leave. And they went out to Finsbury Park Empire together. I went and had a drink in the pub while I let her go. And she told him that she'd met somebody else. And I was down in the pub down not far from where she lived, on my own. And she came in the pub with him. And we shook hands and we became very firm friends ever after. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, if I had to lose her to anybody, he said, I couldn't think of anybody better. And that is a true story. And he's married and got kids of his own now.
Now, anything else happened while you were training in London? I'm not quite sure how long you were there, August to...
I was until round about the Christmas time. I went up to HMS Scotia in Scotland, and I was up there for New Year.
Right, so you left in December. Now, did the Blitz affect you at all, the London Blitz?
Yes, I was down here.
Do you remember much about, any stories of that?
I saw doodle bums, heard the other ones, you heard them before you heard them go off before you heard them coming, the rocket ones.
The V2s.
Yeah. So, because I was in London then, you see, on leave for a number of years.
I see.
I was coming home on leave. So it was, the Blitz was on... while I was training, but it became worse later.
So no particular stories of the Blitz during...
Well, it was at this cinema, I told you. About a week after we went to the cinema, it was no longer a cinema. So there were bombs dropping. But it didn't seem to worry us. I would go out, and I'd go down the West End of London and be on the tube and things like that. And we would go dancing at... Covent Garden, the Yanks were there. London was full of servicemen. It was a very lively place, but bombs were dropping night after night when the Germans came over. But it didn't stop our enjoyment. It didn't seem to worry us.
Now the next thing we want to cover is when you went to Scotia, HMS Scotia, which is a shore station at Ayr, I believe.
Yes.
This was round about December.
Right.
1943. Now tell us about that.
Yeah, the all the chaps who were training with me in London went en bloc up to HMS Scotia, which is the camp was on a beach, and we were housed in Nissen huts, which were heated with just one pot-bellied stove in the middle of the Nissen hut, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that stove a little later. HMS Scotia was more or less the finishing off point where we were working up to top speed and then we would have the final examination. The conditions up there were quite extreme. The weather was very, very, very cold, bitterly cold. And I can remember we were on the parade ground on one occasion, and we were waiting for the officers to come out, inspectors, etc. And you'd have to physically lift your boots off the parade ground because you were actually more or less sort of sticking to the parade ground with the ice. It really was bitter cold. And that's where I did see some bullying.
Well, and tell me about that.
There was a quarrel in a queue waiting to go in for a meal, and the chap just in front of me was headbutted by a Glaswegian, and broke his nose. The Glaswegian broke the chap's nose with a headbutt, and I realised that some of these people from Glasgow would have been on the violent side, as opposed to the, not as opposed, but similar to the people from my hometown, Liverpool. Anyway,
Was there much of that? Was it an isolated case?
It was an isolated case. Normally, we sailors got on pretty well with one another, but certain people would be very, very quick to take offence. And I will tell you a little bit more about that. You may remember I told you about a chap called Bennett, and how his name came out very well in Morse. He was a big, tall chap, and he came from the Pennine area. I think it was Buxton he came from, but he was a big fella. I was a big fella myself, but he was bigger than me. And we elected him when we went to HMS Scotia to be our class leader. He was popular. And when he became class leader, it seemed to change him. He had an ambition to make our class the smartest in HMS Scotia. And shall we put it this way, his elevation to a position of authority, if you like, went to his head. And he became unbearable.
In what way?
In being dictatorial. And anyway, as he was sort of the leader, if you like, of the class, and when we were off duty, he was still very much in charge, even when we were off duty. Well, this pot-bellied stove we used to put a bucket on it and heat the water up to do our washing, because we had to wash our own collars and things like that. And there was a young Geordie chap, and he had been using the stove to get the water hot for quite a long time, and other chaps were waiting their opportunity to put their bucket on the stove, and he was hogging the stove. And they appealed to Bennett to tell him to take his bucket away and let somebody else have a go, and Bennett said no, we let him carry on. And they came to me and said, look, we're getting fed up with this fellow Bennett. He's been very awkward. And I went to reason with him, say, look, he's had his whack. Senses for fair play, really, which I've always had. But he didn't want to know. I'm in charge, and what I say goes. And with that, we said about one another. I'll put it this way, he said about me. And he was very strong, but at the time I didn't box so much. I was more into wrestling. And I put a headlock on him, and I thought if he gets out of this headlock, he'll bloody well kill me. Because it was quite a serious fight. It wasn't just in fun. It really was it was him or me type of thing. I'd challenged his authority, and that's what it was all about. And nobody else joined in. It was just between the pair of us in this listen hut, with the others looking on. Anyway, he was very, very powerfully built, and I had a job to keep him in this headlock, but I kept it on, and he gradually went and subsided, and I thought, I've got to hold on to him, and I felt as if I was strangling him, actually, with it, but I didn't dare let go. I thought, if he gets out of this, he's really going for me, and I very nearly killed him. And it was quite a frightening experience because I obviously didn't want to do anything like that, but it was a touch-and-go situation. Anyway, he did, when I did release him, he just fell to the floor and he didn't come back for more. And I didn't have any more further trouble. I'd mastered him. And that was just an example of the sort of thing where you had to look after yourself.
Did he change his attitude after that?
Yes, he was definitely a bit better after that. But as I say, I did learn to look after myself. I wasn't naturally an aggressive person, but I learned that I really had to stand up for myself. There are other episodes in my naval career later on, but that was at the time.
Now, what sort of training were you doing? You said it was top-up. You've done much of the training.
Yes, we've done the actual learning of the Morse and up to a certain speed. But up at Scotia, they were pushing us to the 25 words a minute, which we needed to do to pass out. And they were also explaining procedures in much more detail than they had done, because all the instructors up there were Royal Naval instructors. The one I'd had in London was an ex-Merchant Navy wireless operator, and he was mainly concentrating on the Morse code itself. So it was a finishing off situation. The other thing I came across up in HMS Scotia was things that they made us do which were nothing to do with training to be a Wallace operator. There were jobs around the camp, and I remember on one occasion I was detailed off to hump bags of coal about and things like that. And the way they would do that is they'd ask if anybody was musical. And if you put your hand up to say you were, then you would be pulled out of the line and given a task. It's a joke maybe now, but it did actually take place in real life. But looking back, I remember vividly the intense cold of the place. I did, in fact, get a cold, but looking back now, I think it was more than a cold. I think it was pneumonia. And I do remember sleeping in my bed. And when I woke up next morning, the blankets were absolutely soaking wet with perspiration, where I'd sort of sweated this cold out. But that's my abiding memory of the place, is the cold.
Now, you weren't there that long, were you? You'd gone there about December.
That's right.
And how long were you there, would you say?
Oh, I'd say a month or 6 weeks, something of that order.
So, to about February?
Yes.
And then you went to Portsmouth, I think. Is there anything else about Scotia?
Yeah, well, what actually happened, when we passed out, we were then drafted from HMS Scotia back to RNB Barracks, Portsmouth. But instead of going into the RNB Barracks, we went into a house called Ladeen. It belonged...
Was that a billet? Or what was that?
It was a detached house with Nissen huts in the grounds, and it had belonged to Beatrice Lilly, the actress. And I was so miserable in this particular naval encampment. We could never get hot water. We had to scrub the wooden floors of these Nissen huts. When you wash the dishes, which is fair enough, we had to do all these chores. We had to wash the dishes in cold water rather than hot water. And it was a sort of holding camp prior to being drafted to ships.
Why was this? I mean, it didn't sound much worse than what you'd been used to. Why do you think it was so bad?
Well, everything about it was... there was mud everywhere when you walked. The weather wasn't very good. It was just a miserable existence. And I managed to get some leave while I was in this place and came up to London to the hotel where I'd been billeted to see my girlfriend, the one who I eventually married. And we had a lovely weekend. And the lady in the hotel laid on a tea for us. She was very kind. And it came the time when I was due to go back to this place at Leydeen. And I was so miserable with the whole thing to do with the Navy. I really didn't want to go back. And I was not going to go back. I was determined to say, I'm going to stay. I'm not going to go back to the Navy. That's it. I've had enough. And I was very, very determined in myself that this was the end of the line as far as I was concerned. War or no war. And
you were going to desert?
I definitely was going to desert.
Did you have any idea of the consequences?
Yes. But the war was on and the air raids were on and our lives were at risk anyway. And I thought, well, rather than risk my life for this kind of thing, I'd take an alternative route. And yes, I did know the consequences, but I was 18 and perhaps headstrong. Anyway, it was my future wife who persuaded me to go back tearfully and came with me to Waterloo Station to catch the train to go back to this place. Rather fortunately, fairly soon after that, I got my draft chit, which I think I will explain in detail.
Now, hang on, just before we come on to that. So, you didn't even go AWOL, I mean, for a
no,
while.
No,
you,
I didn't.
You went back on time.
Yeah, I went back on time.
But it was a temptation. More
very, than. Very strong temptation. Very strong indeed.
And were you doing any duties at Leydeen? Is it L-E-I?
L-E-Y-D-E-N-E.
All one word? Or
all one word, yeah.
Right. And, I mean, what were you, did you have actual duties, you know?
No, not really. It was a holding camp just for like an overflow from Portsmouth RMB.
Now, you would say the drafting procedure.
Yeah. My draft chit came through and I was drafted to HMS Sprat.
Sprat?
S-P-R-A-T-T. HMS Sprat. And I went round asking all the people I knew in the hut, etc., had they ever heard of HMS Sprat? And nobody had. But with a name like that, it sounded like a small ship. I remember just before I actually left the camp, I loaned 10 shillings to a chap I'd palled up with, and he was due to pay me back, but he didn't pay me back because he knew he was on draft himself the following morning, and I've never seen him since. So I learned another bitter lesson. Be careful about lending money because you can't really trust anybody.
Now, what was the procedure when you were drafted? What happened?
Well, what happened, we were taken to P Hut in RNB Portsmouth, for one night stay only. This was a drafting hut, and I'd been given a rather nice cigarette case I was smoking those days by my girlfriend, and I had nowhere to put any personal belongings in this hut, and we slung hammocks, and the only place I could put this cigarette case was in my cap. And somebody must have spotted it, because when I woke up from sleeping in my hammock, the cigarette case was gone. It was stolen. So I remember that quite vividly. It was only one night in RMB, and the next morning, three ship's companies were all collected together, taken by train from Portsmouth to Stranraer in Scotland. And we were in charge of officers, because for wartime secrecy, we were not told where we were going. And we went to Stranraer. We were given little bags with some sandwiches and a bar of chocolate to keep us going. And it was a very long journey in those days. It took about 24 hours to get, with stops and different things, to get to Stranraer. We loaded our, we went to the railway station from the ship at Stranraer to catch the ferry, and the ferry was taking us across to Ireland. Remember, we'd been travelling for about 24 hours, and we were allowed to go to the Naffy in Stranraer. And when I'd left the railway station, there was about 450 sailors loading kit onto a train. We were told we had time to go and get a cup of tea in the local Naffy, where we went. But unfortunately, they'd got a table tennis table in this Naffy, and I played table tennis in those days, quite keen on it, with a chap I'd chummed up with, Jock McGuinness from Scotland, very nice chap. And we finished the game, and by the time we got back to the railway station at Stranraer, the train had gone, and we were the only two sailors on the platform. And when we said to the guard, "Where's that train gone?" he said, "It's gone to, what's the name of the town? Londonderry, Londonderry." We asked him when the next train to Londonderry was, and he said, "Tomorrow. That's the last one today." So he said, "You can get a train up from Belfast, but you'll have to go and come up on a branch line." Remember, we got no tickets or anything like that, but anyway, we got the train to Belfast. We told the ticket collector the story, and he let us go out and get a pint in a pub in Belfast. We caught this other train to Londonderry from Belfast, and all this without not knowing where the devil we were going. And we came towards the outskirts of Londonderry, and we could see naval ships in the distance, and we stopped for quite a while at a little station, and I believe it was called Culmoir, C-U-L-M-O-I-R. There was no railway staff or naval staff anywhere in this railway station. There were chickens in the waiting room, and it was a one-track rail. With Jock McGuinness, he said to me, "Well, we don't know where the devil the ship is. Let's go down to those naval ships and give ourselves up, and they can point us in the right direction." So we got off the train, went down into the dock area where these ships were, and sailors were loading hammocks and kit bags and taking them on board one of the ships. So Jock said, "Grab a hammock and walk aboard," because we're all, in those days you didn't have the name of the ship on your cap bang, you just had HMS, again wartime secrecy. So we walked aboard with all the other sailors, and we said to the chaps when we got on board, "Have you any idea where HMS Spratt is?" And they said, "No, mate, this is HMS Sprague." And there were a number of ships in Londonderry, because they were the ships were coming across from Canada and being got ready for the British Navy in Londonderry. There were a number of these frigates. It was a sort of a frigate base. And by sheer coincidence, we'd walked aboard the very ship I was drafted to, even though my draft sheet had the wrong spelling of the ship. And that's how I arrived. And the people in charge of the draft, the officers, had not missed us. The main draft had gone up into Londonderry from the previous train. They'd had a meal. They hadn't done a muster. And we'd never been missed.